Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much effort does it take to be a friend to animals, or at the very least to avoid doing anything that causes them suffering? While many people are comfortable using animals for food, clothing, entertainment, and scientific experimentation, my guest today believes it is nearly impossible to use animals in this way without causing them inexcusable amounts of pain and distress. And she's hoping to increase the number of Americans willing to stand up for the rights of animals. Ingrid Newkirk is founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, commonly called PETA. Her new book is called The PETA Practical Guide to Animal Rights, Simple Acts of Kindness to Help Animals in Trouble. Ingrid, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris, very much for having me.
Are conditions improving for animals in the United States?
They are indeed, because I can look back to 30 years ago almost, when People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals was founded, and it was pretty bleak. Animals were, I think the term animal rights didn't even exist then, so people didn't think very much about wearing fur. In fact, young women aspired to announce that they had arrived by getting a fur coat. And vegetarian eating really wasn't on the people's radar. We didn't know about the environment and the contribution of factory farming to global warming or climate change, any of those things. So yes, we've come a long way. If you see the crash test dummies on television, then you have to thank PETA, because they used to crash pigs and baboons into walls, and they don't do that anymore. So a lot has changed, and I could go on. But, of course, it's this enormous range of different ways in which animals are used and abused, and I'm afraid those two terms go together. We just don't think of what goes on behind the scenes, but it is what we eat, what we wear, what we buy at the store to clean our houses or our hair, the entertainments that we engage in, and even pest control.
Can you give us a working definition of animal rights as PETA sees it?
Well, yes, it's a bit tricky. I suppose everybody has their own definition. But to me, it's just that we're all in this together, and we shouldn't have one little slice of compassion. We should be as kind as we can to all living beings who we know feel pain and who feel joy, who have maternal love, who don't want to be afraid, who run for their lives. If we know that we can influence how they feel and how they live and how they die, I believe we have a moral responsibility to say that they have the right to be treated kindly by us. And I don't mean that within the context of using them, you know, getting a longer chain for the dog, but really think about whether or not we should be using them at all, because we're all animals, we're all under the skin, biologically pretty much the same, we're just in strange different packages, and I believe that they have the right, as we do, not to be tormented, oppressed, treated violently, and needlessly hurt and killed.
One thing that might take people by surprise is PETA's objection to the use of wool. Can you talk about the shearing procedures that really concern you?
It actually isn't so much the shearing, although if anybody has seen commercial shearing, it certainly is quite grisly, because the cutters work, the shearers work extremely quickly. There's money and speed for them and numbers, and so they yank the sheep up or upside down, depending on what they're doing. And they shear so quickly that they do take off small tumors, they make nicks, they do frighten many of the sheep. And if there is some wound or something, they don't slow down. So I've seen sheep standing after being shorn, absolutely shaking with fear and covered in nicks and cuts. But that isn't it. I went to Australia at the invitation of 60 Minutes over there to go around the sheep farms, because most of the wool in the world that ends up anywhere in the stores here as well comes from Australian sheep. And what I discovered was that the lambs, and the wool industry doesn't mention this to anybody for what will become obvious reasons, the lambs are taken when they're very small, and the farmers use a pair of gardening shears, no painkiller whatsoever, and cut off the flesh, not the wool, the flesh on their rumps. And it is the most incredibly painful procedure. Afterwards, the lambs can't walk. They just crumple to the ground. And 3 or 4 days later, when they're able to stand, they move sideways like little crabs across the ground because it's so painful. The reason that's done is because back in the 1920s, a man called John Mules, this procedure is called mulesing, decided that the cheapest, easiest way to stop flies laying their eggs under the lamb's tails was to cut off the rump flesh and create scar tissue. And so it's absolutely inexcusable, and I wanted the world to know that and start boycotting at least Australian wool.
Ingrid Newkirk is my guest. She is founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. She's got a new book out called The PETA Practical Guide to Animal Rights, Simple Acts of Kindness to Help Animals in Trouble. You can join us this afternoon by calling 1-800-933-5372, and that is where we find Bonnie in Rowlett. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I appreciate this topic. I will admit there's little known about PETA other than what we see in the news. And so having said that, my question comes from that angle. I grew up on a ranch, raised Barbados lambs. We didn't do any of those kinds of things that you already talked about. I understand animal husbandry is a skill that a lot of people don't even understand. But one of the things that I had a question about was, I want to know if PETA, as an organization, endorses or encourages their supporters to commit criminal activity towards private property, private landowners, or if those are just kind of like the lunatic fringe, if you will, that all organizations that are trying to, you know, I can think of the pro-life versus the pro-abortion, you know, there's different sides to the color of the
sure.
rainbow. People that support the organization can sometimes take things into their own hands.
Yeah,
what is the official endorsement or lack thereof that PETA has on these violent acts against private landowners?
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Bonnie. I think anyone can look at our website, not just take my word for it, but read any of our publications and our books. We're accused of a lot of things, but actually everything we've always said from the word go has been to try to get people to change their minds, to change their hearts, to learn more about animals. And we are not involved in attacking. We're trying to stop violence, not create it. So no, we don't ask people to do anything like that. If I may say, I was raised as part of my childhood, my early childhood, on a farm in Cornwall, and then I went abroad. But my family always thought we were kind to animals, yet I think we were basically eating our way through the animal kingdom. There was no, we didn't see it as any contradiction. And I had my first fur coat when I was 19. So I always say to people, I really relate to the fact that human beings learn things, they see things, they have their eyes opened, and they hopefully, usually, change, especially if you make it easy for them. So our goal is to say, look, you may not realize what's happening in the slaughterhouse, although I think most of us know in our hearts, or what's happening on the Chinese fur farms, for example. But here is what's happening. Don't be depressed, but here is also, let us do the homework for you. Here are options. Here are kind choices you can make. And in all the books, all the pamphlets, everything on the website, PETA.org, you find alternatives to any use of animals so that you can just be as kind as you want to be.
There are vegetarians who still eat dairy products. Can you talk about why you choose to stay away from even organic milk and eggs?
Yes. Now, organic, of course, simply means no pesticides, nothing like that put into them, and doesn't necessarily address the humane conditions or lack thereof. But I was a vegetarian because of a little pig, and there's a little pig on the cover of my book, as you know, with his mother, and it's a wonderful-looking relationship. They just love each other. I became vegetarian because of an incident with a pig, but later somebody came to see me from Europe and said to me, do you eat veal? And I said, no, of course not. We haven't eaten veal in my household since I was 7, and my mother found out how veal calves are raised. But he said, so why do you put milk in your tea? And I said, what's the relationship? And he told me, he said, you realize that the veal industry, the thing you abhor, was created because we need to sell that milk. The farmer wants to sell that milk. And in order to sell the milk, you have to get rid of the calf because milk is created for that calf and only for that calf to drink. So you have to do something with the calf. So off the male calves go into the veal crate. And that upset me. I started to look at the dairy industry, and it's become worse and worse over the 30 years I've been looking at it. In California, they actually have a series of ads called Happy Cheese from Happy Cows. I don't know if anyone's seen that. It's also in Wisconsin, other places. And you see these happy cartoon cows in rolling green acres of fields with their grandkids around them having a wonderful time. In reality, the cows, most of the cows raised for milk or cheese, dairy cows, are in barren lots. There isn't a stump of anything. There isn't a blade of grass. They're up to their hocks in mud and their own waste. They are out in the burning sun. They're out in the cold. And their calves are taken away from them when they are just hours old, and that mother loves that calf. But the farmer comes along, puts a chain on the animal's leg, and hauls him off by a tractor. And you'll see on our website this video of mother cows trying to get in front of the tractor to stop her baby from being taken away. So I just don't want to support it. I have soy milk, rice milk, wonderful things, but I cannot support it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sandy in Dallas. Hello, Sandy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would love to know, what is PETA's position regarding dogs for the blind or assisted living? I mean, there are dogs out there who, if they don't have objectives in their lives, actually get into more harm than good. So I'm curious as to PETA's position regarding that.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Sandy. It's complicated, like most things in life. We're very much in favor of some working dogs and not in favor of others. My favorite program, and I'm a patron of it, is the Hearing Ear Dogs program, and that's dogs for the deaf. And these dogs have a usually wonderful life because they're not kept in the traces the way many guide dogs for the blind are. You know, you are not encouraged, and it's understandable, but you're not encouraged to pet or talk to any dog who is working with a blind person. Hearing ear dogs, of course, have the run of the house. They're engaged in all sorts of things. There are no such restrictions. Guide dogs for the blind, I have some problems with their program generally, just the way they work it out, because the puppies are born in one place. With hearing ear dogs, they get dogs from the shelters. With guide dogs for the blind, they breed the dogs, and I think in these times when you cannot find homes for all these wonderful dogs who are being put down at the shelters, it's not good to breed more. Go and get them from the shelter. They then ship them off to a blind person, and when those dogs get old, and they may have been with that person for years, they're shipped back out of the way, as if this family, this relationship doesn't mean anything to them. There are many problems with that, but working dogs, there are many good working dog opportunities, and it gives a dog a full life if it's a good, humane situation.
Ingrid Newkirk is my guest. She's founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Her new book is called The PETA Practical Guide to Animal Rights, Simple Acts of Kindness to Help Animals in Trouble. We'll return to our conversation in a moment, and you can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Ingrid Newkirk. Her new book is called The PETA Practical Guide to Animal Rights, Simple Acts of Kindness to Help Animals in Trouble. You can join us via email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Ingrid, I think a lot of people who care about animals, who come upon, say, a dog or a cat that they can't care for that's in their neighborhood or something, think the first and best place to go is a no-kill animal shelter. And as with many issues that come up in the book, this isn't necessarily the path that you would take. Can you talk about why?
Yes, and this may run counter to what most people think when they hear the words no-kill. It sounds wonderful, and it should be wonderful. But unfortunately, and all over the country, we're experiencing the same thing. We have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dogs and cats and not enough homes to put them into. Those animals must all have something happen to them. You cannot let them, or you should not let them, be out on the streets in danger of being run over or being abused by juveniles or the things that actually happen to them out there. They have to go somewhere. And unfortunately, people do acquire animals casually. They put down a credit card in the mall and take a puppy home, and then it's too inconvenient. It wets on the rug or it barks, and off he goes to the shelter. But the no-kill shelters have a finite number of animals they can take in, or they couldn't be no-kill. So they sound good, but it means that they have to slam the door in the face of so many animals with nowhere to go. So what happens to those? They end up at what's called open admission shelters. And these are often the much derided pounds or the municipal shelters where they just take in all comers, the lame, the halt, the sick, the aged, and they have to do something. People usually want to adopt bouncy, fluffy, small puppies and kittens. They don't want these lanky, mixed this and that, who have been out on a chain perhaps for 8 years or something, or have a gimpy leg. They know what they want. So the shelters have to do something with them, and they're not going to hopefully give them into laboratory experiments or have them go and live out their last years as a guard dog somewhere. They need to put them down. And I think to me the question is how you do this. That they are put to sleep with absolute kindness, held in loving arms, and that they don't know they're going. That's the service to them. It may be the kindest thing that's ever been done, but it requires great courage to do it and not to feel you've let them down, because there simply isn't another solution. Everyone's scrambling to find homes, and there aren't enough good homes to go around. We need to spay and neuter, get people out of the pet shops, away from the breeders, down to all the shelters, but not deride the wonderful agencies that do society's dirty work.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Maury in Duncanville. Hi, Maury.
Hi. I'm actually a former PETA member. I stopped my membership when I found out that PETA is actually engaged in euthanizing animals. I had a situation where a wild cat, I wanted to take proper responsibility for it, and I learned about it on the internet. It's called trap, neuter, and release. And the idea is that you neuter or spay an animal, a cat particularly, and then it's able to live naturally in its environment, and it even keeps down rodent population, et cetera. You don't have to kill it, and it keeps away other animals that would want to come in, so that you don't have to take it to the pound where, you know, in that neighborhood, another wildcat would just come in. So instead it claims its territory.
Right.
And I was really disappointed to find out PETA is engaged in euthanasia.
I'd like to ask Kirk
about that, please.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't mind getting our hands dirty if we think it's the right thing to do. We do endorse some trap, neuter, and release programs, but they have to have rules, and most of them don't. I think it's better than nothing to take a cat who's been abandoned, say, at a dumpster somewhere, and get them sterilized and put them back. That's better than doing nothing. But I've been a humane officer before I was at PETA for many, many years, and I can promise everyone there is no kind, quiet end for those cats out there. They're not naturally wild. They are relatively recently domesticated and dumped out there, and they get fleas, they get internal parasites, they get all manner of diseases, including feline AIDS. They get beaten up and they get abscesses. People hurt them. They get caught in the dumpsters. They get run over. They're cold in winter. They're looking for water in summer. It's 100 and something in Dallas today. I think 101, isn't it? And, you know, those cats are out there just trying not to dehydrate. They're looking for some, and it may go on for days, looking for something to drink. So I think that it may seem, oh, I didn't have to kill them, and I understand that. But to me, sometimes it's trap, neuter, and abandon, and that's not right. If you have a cat at home, you know that a good portion of your time over the years is spent taking your cat to the vet. They need shots. They need all sorts of things, and you find out your cat might have a heart murmur, or your cat has cancer, or your cat... These cats who are released back out into the dumpster area or the alleyway or wherever are not going to have that ever be taken to the vet again. They usually will never trap, even if someone notices that they're ill. So if there are caretakers who really do more than just feed or sterilize, it could be okay if the area is safe and they're not going to come to any harm. But willy-nilly, just putting them back out there and sterilizing them for the sake of not putting them down, no, we don't agree with it, and we do euthanize. We actually have a free service because the vets charge an arm and a leg, and a lot of people these days especially can't afford it. We have a service in Norfolk, Virginia, and on the Carolina border, very impoverished area. If you have an animal who's aged or is aggressive, has been out on a chain his whole life perhaps, never socialized, hit by a car, we will euthanize that animal for nothing. And if you go to helpinganimals.com, our website, you will see the photographs of the animals we have put out of their misery. It's dirty work, but we'll do it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Brian in Dallas. Hey, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling because it seems to me that PETA fights for animals to have the same rights, I guess, that we do. And my question is in regard to any TV show you might turn on Animal Planet where you see lions or tigers maybe capturing an animal and torturing it a little bit, injuring it so that the cubs can bat it around and torture it further to sort of learn how to do what they do in the wild. And it seems to me that in the wild, this sort of torture happens between animals constantly, and I just wonder why we should be held to some sort of a different standard. I mean, I agree that what you spoke of earlier as far as the sheep, you know, having their rumps cut off is a terrible thing, but at the same time, I just would like to hear your thoughts on, you know, why animals couldn't be held to the same standard. And I'll take my answer off air.
Thanks for your call. Ingrid, I know this is a concern that you've responded to many times in the past.
Well, yes, and I think the reason I have is because Brian is right. People want to know that. We don't really want the same rights for animals. I'm not sure they couldn't have done a better job voting over the years than we did. And they don't need to drive a car or anything like that. But I do think the basic rights for them, because we think of ourselves as this thinking animal, as magnanimous and kind and compassionate. Nobody wants to be cruel to animals unless there's something wrong with them. And yet we deny them the very basic rights, which are the right not to feel needless pain, the right not to be picked on just because you're different, the right not to be violently abused just because somebody wants a sandwich or they want a handbag made of a crocodile or lizard or snake or something. I mean, all the ways in which we just deny animals the right simply to have a life free of pain and suffering for no good reason. But in the wild, I can't control, do anything about nature. I mean, nature is cruel in many respects. He's absolutely right, of course. But we have so many choices. a lion or pride of lions usually eats out of need, and we eat out of greed, if you'll pardon me, but we have all this wonderful array of choices. We have supermarkets, and we can choose anything to eat that we wish, and we have fabulous vegetarian choices that are actually better for us because we are not true carnivores. You know, we have not got the physiology to digest meat and dairy products the way a big cat does. And so it does come back to haunt us with clogged arteries and cancer and stroke and these things. But we also want to be kind, and we can do that. I can't say this to lions. They don't understand a word I'm saying. But I can say to us, well, if we have a choice, let's make the kind choice and get away from it and try not to pick on. And we usually do. We pick on the vegetarian animals. We pick on the most passive animals, the cows and the lambs and the chickens, who are not themselves carnivores.
And while we're at this, because we just came off an hour where we talked about the dearth of health care for innocent people living in Sudan, PETA's position is not that animal rights should be instead of human rights or caring for humans. It's simply your sense is that we can try to take care of this for animals and for humans.
Oh, yes. I mean, you don't have to jump over a homeless person to help a stray dog. And in fact, we have a saying that animal rights is human rights because we're sold a bill of goods by advertisers. It's buy this, buy that, you know, have your Oscar Mayer hot dog, have your... And we don't stop and research every single thing. We can't. We're too busy. But we have the United Nations coming out with this report. It just came out with saying, you can buy a Prius, you can change your light bulbs, you can shower with a friend, but at the end of it all, you're not doing anything for the environment as much as if you went vegetarian because of factory farming, taking the groundwater, the topsoil, doing all these things, causing climate change. So that's for human benefit if we get rid of the problems or try to turn the clock back a bit on those problems. We know that going vegetarian is better for our health. It's better for longevity. It's better for energy. And it really does help us beat the odds on the big diseases that are killing most people today. 3 out of 4 Americans, 2 out of 4 Americans, depending on whether it's cancer, it's heart disease, or whatever it is. So diabetes is a problem. Overweight is a problem. And especially among low-income people who have only fast food restaurants in their neighborhoods a lot of the time and have no nutrition education at their fingertips. They're not on the internet. They can't look up things about health, and so they are going down the tubes. And so a vegetarian diet helps everybody, including the poorest of the poor.
My guest is PETA President Ingrid Newkirk. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Butch in Burleson. Hello, Butch.
Yes, ma'am. I had a question, several comments that I listened to more and more. But my one question was about the adoption program that PETA operates out of their kennel in Virginia. I had taken some stats from the Internet. I don't know, I think their best year ever was in 2001 where they adopted out 26% of the animals that they brought into their shelter. In 2008, that slipped to less than 1%, and they're taking in 400 or 500 fewer dogs in 2008 than they did in 2001, and it seems that they're going the opposite way. Instead of taking animals in and caring for them, they're taking them in for the purpose of euthanizing them.
Well, let's get a response. First of all, Ingrid, do those numbers jibe with what your research says?
I haven't got numbers with me, but I can tell you that you're onto something there, Butch, because, yes, we are changing. What we do now is we work with every local shelter, and we're in an area of 5 different jurisdictions. So what we do, we don't have a kennel, by the way. We have a euthanasia service, as I described, for the old, the sick, the, you know, people who don't have the money to go to the vet. And we take in the most decrepit of animals for euthanasia, usually. Some of them we can place, and those we do, but those are a very small number. What we now don't do, we're sort of a reverse shelter, is we don't take in highly adoptable animals. We refer those to the shelters in the 5 areas and to the adoption and placement societies where they have foot traffic specifically to come and look for an animal. So we are actually stopping them before they get to us and sending them to places where there are adoption services. So we only take in the worst.
There is a pretty significant problem in this part of the country, Ingrid, with people who have rodents in their attics, in their garages. Is there a humane way to deal with this problem?
There is. And in fact, on PETA.org, and this, of course, ever since President Obama swatted the fly, pest control has come up constantly. And we even have, for insects, we have a thing called Catch a Bug, which I think 116 of them sold in the first 20 hours of the Obama fly story. And you can put a, of course you can use a glass too, but just catch an insect, put him outside. So you can care about even the least of them and the least familiar of them. But yes, there's a difference between taking a sort of Wyatt Earp approach, using a gut-wrenching poison on a little animal. You may not like that animal. That animal might scare the living daylights out of you. But really, you're the big one in control. And they're little mammals, just like a dog or us, and they don't want to die badly of some painful chemical that you put down or some snap trap, or worse probably is the glue trap, which should be banned because these animals, mice, birds, squirrels, get caught in it. Even a hamster from someone's house got caught in one the other day when they escaped, and they tear off their limbs, their noses, by getting their faces and limbs stuck in this gluey substance. So yes, you can get a thing called a have-a-heart trap, which is just a little box, and there are many variations. You can go to PETA.org and look for them. The animal goes inside, the door closes, you can then put them outside. But seal up the holes in your house that they're coming into, that's the key.
So keep them out in the first place.
Yes, and then when you get them out, seal up the holes so they don't come back.
Ingrid Newkirk is with us. Her new book is called The PETA Practical Guide to Animal Rights, Simple Acts of Kindness to Help Animals in Trouble. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. You can get to us at think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is PETA founder and president Ingrid Newkirk. Her new book is called The PETA Practical Guide to Animal Rights, Simple Acts of Kindness to Help Animals in Trouble. Ingrid, you remind us in the book of the importance of making sure that our trash is not a hazard to the animals who might come in contact with it. Can you talk about that?
Sure. There are just some very simple things. You know, we have destroyed so much of animals' habitat. Raccoons and possums and all these animals who used to live where we now have our homes and our shopping malls and skating rinks and highways are eking out an existence. And so obviously with berry bushes gone and nut trees and the things that they were able to sustain themselves and their young with gone, they then smell our trash and that draws them in. They shouldn't be punished for it with any painful poisons that people put out or cruel kinds of traps. I think we need to take responsibility. Don't put your trash out until the last moment. Make sure it's sealed as tight as it possibly can in the bag, and then that you're using the kind of trash can that a raccoon or another animal cannot fall into. The smell of many of these animals, their nostrils are very sensitive. They have far more sensors in them than ours do. They're drawn from long distances to try to come and eat what they can detect. So I think it's incumbent upon us to try to do our best to deter them by not having them smell what's going on.
Let's go back to the phones now and speak with John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi there. I actually had called in to disagree with Ms. Newkirk about the no-kill shelters. I actually know and work with several people who work together in sort of a human network to move animals from different locations back and forth to areas where there is a high population of homeless animals to places where there is a lower population, because there's a misconception about this animal overpopulation thing. That's actually a regional thing where certain areas will have an overpopulation and certain areas will have an underpopulation and open homes. So what we do with this human network is that we move them back and forth. We work best with no-kill shelters because, unlike municipal shelters, which are they have to abide by city regulations, they can't turn animals over to human networks that provide foster homes, networks that can move animals to a different city or a different state sometimes.
Well, it sounds like you've got a great setup there, John. Ingrid, would you like to comment on that?
Sure, and I think everything depends on the people who are running it, and there are some very good foster care programs. I think what many, and some municipal shelters work with them, in fact, many of them do across the country. One of the problems has been, and I have yet to find any jurisdiction in the United States where there is an underpopulation of animals. I think that is a pleasant dream, but it's just not the case. What happens sometimes is because no-kill philosophy moves into an area, then that area stops trapping animals who are ill or injured or abandoned or out there on the street. They reduce their services so that fewer animals are able to come into the shelter. That creates abandonment. It creates all sorts of other problems where people who are not willing to, say, give a fee to a shelter in order to drop off an animal just do something else. So you find that it's a sort of it's a fallacy. But I think that one of the things that many law enforcement people are afraid of is a lot of people who are involved in no-kill, and I don't mean this as an across-the-board disparagement, because there are wonderful people that we work with, too, in no-kill, but some people are hoarders, and you find that they take on all these animals that they are saving from the shelters. They end up in cages, in the basement, warehoused here and there, passed on to substandard homes, and passed on from pillar to post, because there is such a desperation not to kill them that the quality of life is an issue that's not properly addressed. And that is, if you read the Humane Society news for the Humane Society of the United States or so on, you see that these people are getting busted all the time for the desperation not to kill has led to neglect in many cases. And even our website, you will see some places where we've worked with law enforcement to actually serve warrants on some of these places, because the conditions are just so grossly inhumane.
And it also bears pointing out here, to be fair, that there are people working in municipal shelters where euthanasia is practiced who do, in fact, care deeply about the welfare of animals. This is not all savage people who don't care about dogs and cats and other pet animals.
That's absolutely true. And, of course, we also, I mean, in fairness, too, well, if we find somebody in a municipal shelter and we hear about them and they're selling dogs out of the back door for fighting, or they are denying animals veterinary care, letting them languish in a kennel without attention, I mean, we will try to get them prosecuted. We'll try to get them kicked out, because only people who care should be in the shelters. But like any other job, that's not always what happens. But there are wonderful, caring people, and some of them are the very people who are despised because they have to take that final step, is hold that wonderful animal in their arms and appease them, soothe them, tell them that they're loved, and then let them disappear from a world that never cared for them.
Let's go next to Arlington and speak with Laura. Hey, Laura.
Hi. Laura had to go to work, but I'm going to ask her question for her.
All right. Who am I speaking to?
My name is Brian.
Brian. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, Laura's question was about the Planet Primate facility here in Texas that the state took over receivership some time ago because of the conditions that were happening to the animals. And an organization called Friends for Animals made vast improvements, and PETA was suing them. And I'm trying to find out what PETA's ultimate goal is, whether they want to euthanize the animals or if they want to improve the facility so that the animals can be properly cared for. Because it seems to me that money for the lawsuit is taking away money that could be going to the care of the animals.
Are you familiar with the case, first of all, Ingrid?
I am. That's a sort of not exactly how it, and it's too complicated to go into, but I can say I do know the facility, and there were complaints about it for decades. Employees left, volunteers left, and everyone and their brother was going to the attorney general and the state's attorney asking for help for the animals at primarily primates. Another group has come in now, but that group was friendly with the previous management, and in fact, the new executive director used to live on the property and was the friend, dear friend, of the man who ran it and neglected the animals. There was a chimpanzee who was shot to death with a shotgun after lying covered in fire ants down on the floor of his pen for days. The place was so incredibly neglected, and the animals were left to die and, in fact, freeze to death in their nest boxes without any heat in winter. And the man who is the new executive director was on the property all the time when the old regime was there. So until he's gone, I think nobody can really feel safe that the animals, no matter what cosmetic or other improvements are made, is enough. And in fact, there isn't even a full-time veterinarian there, even though they have hundreds and hundreds of animals. And there's no primatologist, and yet they have hundreds of monkeys and chimpanzees.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Jerry in Plano. Hey, Jerry.
Hey.
Hi.
I wanted to say a fantastic show. I really appreciate you guys doing this. And just make the comment that I don't think the problem is PETA. The problem is just too many uneducated people. There's not enough good homes for these animals. And given the choice, I mean, why wouldn't we be kind to animals? It makes no sense. And the fact that PETA is no longer a no-kill, well, you know, you can't warehouse hundreds and thousands of animals. So they're not the problem, and it seems like people are being a bit critical, and you know, I support any organization that's trying to make a positive impact in educating people, because that's really what it's about. We've got to get educated and get better laws, and I just really appreciate the show. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Jerry. If I could just say one thing there, Chris, is I appreciate that call for another reason, is because everybody can make a difference. If somebody doesn't like what we're doing, fair enough. But all the time and money and attention that goes into placing animals, really, as hard as it is to imagine not doing that, I think putting it into spaying and neutering so that more and more homeless animals aren't being born, and then we aren't having to try to find homes, and mostly fruitlessly for them, is where our time, effort, and money could go most wisely. At PETA, we do a little drop in the bucket, like anything else. Is we have two full-time spay and neuter clinics that go into low-income areas, and for no cost or low cost, you can get your animal completely taken care of in every way and sterilized. So, you know, the buck stops there. And if anyone's listening and is tempted to go to a breeder, tempted to go to a pet store, please don't go to the shelter. Go to the shelter instead. But get two if you have the time, the love, the patience, the money, the respect for them, so they can keep each other company while you're at work or at school. But most importantly, please help everybody get animals spayed and neutered so that we can deal with the existing population and not having to try to keep up and not be able to keep up with this influx of new animals needing to be placed, and many of them not going to win that lottery.
You mentioned people not going to pet stores, and that, I suppose, would solve this issue. But people might be surprised to hear that PETA does not encourage the keeping of things like fish as pets.
Well, no. I think it's, I don't think any animal is a living decoration, and I certainly used to have an aquarium, and I actually came to know, and I talk about in the book, a fish who, a banded severum, who grew to be quite large, and I had to keep expanding the tank and expanding the tank. And this fish was in love with my ex-husband. So was I at the time. But if he would, at 4:30 in the afternoon, which is about the time his man came home, this fish would swim from one end of the tank where he'd been in the sun to the other so he could face the door and watch for him to come through. And then if he would turn on one side, turn on the other, and allow himself to be just touched on the top of his fins. He had such a life that he created in this little aquarium that I came to wonder where he had come from, what his life would have been like if he hadn't been in captivity, whether he'd have been with others of his own kind. And over the years, I've read so many stories about how smart fish are, how they have their own little language, which is like the chirping of birds, only it's underwater, that they enjoy things. They actually decorate part of where they live, and they don't like some fish, and they like others. And I've seen and heard so many things now that I just wish we'd just leave animals in peace.
Let's go next to Matt in McKinney. Hello, Matt.
Hi. I just wanted to make a point about, yes, it seems all well and nice. I mean, we could do small acts of kindness to the smaller, cuter animals at first, and maybe that would make everything better. But it just seems that PETA's long-term goals of moving to a vegetarian society and letting all the animals free and letting them have their lives just seems extremely impractical for the human race.
You want to respond?
Why, Matt, do you think it's impractical?
Well, it just seems like if we're to let them all go, I mean, the animals would just kind of take care of themselves, and would we be able to grow enough food for everyone?
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, of course, it's actually, I think, the reverse, because we're not going to have a vegetarian world overnight. Is that people gradually stop eating meat and move on to other foods, and that you see that particularly with young people. The colleges are full of vegan cafeterias and vegetarian meal lines now and so on. But what we do today is that we breed and breed masses of animals. We artificially inseminate them. We superovulate them. We force their bodies to produce more milk, more meat, to be so top-heavy in the case of birds than anything in nature. So it's not that we just create them and kill them. It's that we put them through quite a lot of misery on the way to the slaughterhouse, and we wouldn't be breeding and creating all these animals just to kill as we gradually become a vegetarian society. But if you read PETA.org, Earth Save is another good website, and even the United Nations has a great website. It shows that actually we could feed the world, the whole world, on a vegetarian diet because it doesn't deplete topsoil, it doesn't drain the aquifers, it doesn't cause deforestation. It is environmentally and health-wise a great way to eat.
Ingrid Newkirk is founder and president of PETA. Her new book is The PETA Practical Guide to Animal Rights. Ingrid, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris, very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.